Hey, everybody. This is Matt, the Toothless Philosopher. I want to say thank you for joining me on today's episode. I want to talk about free will. Now, for anybody who's grown up in, I'll just say, the church, I'm sure you understand this concept fairly well. For those of you who are unfamiliar with, you know, putting those two words together, on a generic level, it's choice. It's that human beings have choice. We as people, we have the ability to make decisions, which is great. I mean, it's great to have that idea of kind of self-determination, of agency, of all the things that make us become who we are when it's within our control. But some of the things that I've learned growing up from stepping away from the faith that raised me, essentially, is that it's not necessarily that simple, if you can help it. And that becomes the other part of this equation, the if you can help it. Now, the thing about free will that I think that a lot of the religious movements get wrong, and a lot of where even just the people kind of misconstrue, is that because you have free will, because you can make choices, means you can simply resolve situations. You can simply make a better life for yourself. You just make a different choice. Not getting paid enough? Find another job. The rent's too high? Move. And we know that there are elements to this that it's out of our control. If the market isn't working for housing or for, you know, for jobs, you can make all the choices you want, but you don't make everyone's choice for them. You don't have control over whether you get hired. You don't have control over whether you get a raise. The most you can do is react. But ultimately, you know, the thing about choice and free will and this picking yourself up by your bootstraps, which is not, the cliche isn't right. It's everybody's free choice, free will, bouncing around everybody else's free will. It's just not that simple. So that was already kind of an issue for me. And I mean, the other issue, honestly, is that, you know, God has a plan for you. God has a destiny for you. Your existence is kind of preordained, predetermined. But then I can make a choice to deny that. I can make a choice that hinders that, that halts it completely. So for the, you know, evangelical God that I grew up with, who was all powerful, all knowing, all good, could be deterred by a kid, a lot of this stuff became problematic for me as I got older. I started to ask a lot of questions. I started to see people also kind of for who they were. So there's a lot of inconsistency, and we would just call it hypocrisy, in the church that really bugged me. Inconsistencies in the holy books got to me, which I've since expanded upon. I've been looking into things for 25 years now. I'm still an amateur as far as I'm concerned. I'm definitely not an expert. I know less than anybody who's gone to school for it. I mean, that's just the reality. I could probably hold a conversation with those people, but they would leaps and bounds over me, right? So I don't want to come in here and say that I know more than I know. I know enough to ask more questions. That's pretty much the mantra of my existence. And, you know, I think questions are really important. They're important to ask. They're important to find the right people to ask, even, or just to ask amongst people that are potentially like-minded, to at least kind of get the ball rolling. And some people that are not like-minded. I think if you can have a conversation with people that you know you don't agree with on a topic, it's valuable. It's valuable to poke holes in what they're purporting while they poke holes in what you're purporting. And sometimes that's tough, because I care more about some of these topics than other people, but other people care more about, I don't know, cooking, you know, feeding themselves, cleaning stuff up. I mean, I'm a mess of a human being in many respects, but I have a real interest in learning more, trying to gain more knowledge, trying to cross-connect things. So I'm always asking questions, right? And to me, I have believed for a long time that that was my choice. That was part of my free will. That was my own decision-making. Then I ran across Sam Harris. Now, this was years ago, but at the time, Sam Harris was, and he still is, I mean, an author. He has a podcast. He has a PhD in cognitive neuroscience. I watched him debate people about religion, about all kinds of religion. He definitely has a real concern about Islam, and not from the sense of being, you know, hateful of Islam itself. It's more about the doctrine and not Islamists. You know, the various doctrines that are bubbling up to the top, bubbling up to the surface. It's the same thing, you know, in my brain as those who are far right wing racists, fascists, neo-Nazis, or full-on Nazi people that are trying to use various aspects of the Bible as their basis for hate. So yeah, Sam Harris, I'm a fan. I'm a fan of his work. I'm a fan of how he presents himself. And, you know, he wrote a book called Free Will. He's written a few books. I think Losing Faith and The Moral Landscape and a couple others, which I should have in my collection. I don't. I should get them, and I should really invest time in all of them. I should reread Free Will, actually, now that I'm rambling on about it. He's not the focal point of where I'm headed, but he's the start. And the thing that he was suggesting, and I heard him on his podcast once or twice as well, is that the further understanding we gain about the brain from a, you know, neurological standpoint, let's say, the further away the idea of free will is realistic. And I'll get into more clarity or a different couple of examples about that in a minute. But I found this idea really intriguing and also really challenging because, of course, I don't have a neuroscientific background, and I don't know that I fully understood all of his arguments within his book, Free Will. So, but I will say this, right? So to kind of sum up his own kind of perspective within the book, as far as what it is I'm about to kind of get into, right? This is a quote from Sam Harris. The popular conception of free will seems to rest on two assumptions. One, that each of us could have behaved differently than we did in the past. And two, that we are the conscious source of most of our thoughts and actions in the present. As we are about to see, however, both of these assumptions are false. So this is a real dilemma, you know, as far as the idea of free will, as far as, well, geez, if I'm not the one making the choice, then who's making the choice? Because again, I grew up with this idea that I was given choice by something, by somebody. And even though I stopped believing that somebody existed, I still have the premise that anything that I do is because I'm somehow allowed to do it. And some of that verbiage still kind of kicks in when I'm talking about it, thinking about it just on the fly. It's a weird concept, I think, to just try to de-rationalize yourself from, as it were, or deconstruct, I think, is what some of the cool kids are saying nowadays. So this was a challenging concept. You know, I didn't know where to go with it. I didn't really take the time to dive into it. I mean, I read the book. I've got notes on it. I've got highlights on it from inside the book. But I never really sat down and kind of struggled over it, you know? And the other book that I'm reading now is giving me a reason to go back. It's giving me a reason to really delve into this. Because right now, I'm reading a book by a man named Robert Sapolsky. And Robert Sapolsky, he is a neuroendocrinology researcher and author. He's got a bunch of books. He's written a bunch of scientific papers. He's a professor of biology, neurology, neurological sciences, and neurosurgery at Stanford University. I actually fell into knowing who this guy is because of some videos that were being posted on YouTube from his classes, from the training, the teaching he was giving at Stanford. And I found them fascinating. I found them so interesting. His delivery is so, you know, where Sam Harris has a more monotone, kind of deliberate sound to him, you know, Sapolsky has an almost meek look and feel to him. You know, if Jesus and Santa Claus had a baby, it would look like Robert Sapolsky, right? He's got wild curly hair. He's got a big wild beard. And he doesn't talk like he's trying to make a point. He just says what he's saying. You know, he's got a real interesting style. If anybody wants to take a look and let me know if they agree with my take, or if they have some other take, that's fine. Sapolsky, Sapolsky, for anybody who can't understand me or needs help with the spelling. I really like it. I like what he's about, what he's been doing. And he takes a much harder stance, especially now, as far as the idea that free will is not a thing. And I mean, to quote him as well, to quote him directly, right? He says, even I think that taking that seriously sounds absolutely nutty. Let me back up. This quote from him is about free will not being a thing. And I believe it's also about punishing people for their actions when there's no free will is also something he does not agree with. It's all part and parcel with what it is that he's professing. And he certainly suggests that these are separate items, but he believes that, you know, the ultimately the outcome of free will not being real is that the punishments are more, you know, retribution than they are punishment because of something that somebody did when it wasn't exactly up to them or wasn't up to them at all because we don't have free will. So his quote, and even I think that taking that seriously sounds absolutely nutty. I haven't believed in free will since adolescence, and it's been a moral imperative for me to view humans without judgment or the belief that anyone deserves anything special to live without a capacity for hatred or entitlement. And I just can't do it. Sure, sometimes I can sort of get there, but it is rare that my immediate response to events aligns with what I think is the only acceptable way to understand human behavior. So this, to some extent, is still kind of, I mean, it's even for people who believe in what it is that they're saying, finds it difficult to live it. It's not, I don't want to say that it's not normal, but it's just unusual. I think it's not normal from a Western civilization perspective because of the massive amount of religion and various forms of Christianity that have been embedded into us. I think it's culturally a very difficult concept to wrestle with. So I'm reading this book, and I've only gotten through chapter one, right? I read Sam Harris's book a number of years ago. I'm going to have to start it over again, clearly. And I've gotten through chapter one of Sapolsky's book. It's called, very specifically, the long form, it is Determined, A Science of Life Without Free Will. Determined. So this is one of the issues that I have. I have a couple of issues. One, the idea of not bringing punishment for at least certain specific actions, even though they're out of someone's control. We put down animals when they have rabies, right? When they're ruthlessly attacking whatever, right? Kids, other animals, old ladies, we put them down. So I find it somehow contentious that the same people who would tell me that humans are animals, but we can't put them down, even though we already put down animals. I find that confusing. Now, I don't know if Sapolsky necessarily is into the death penalty for, you know, animals. I assume he's got to have some sort of take on it. I mean, in the book, he talks about how he's a neuroscientist with a lab whose job it is to, you know, rewire rats' brains to perform different behaviors. So the other issue that I have, just kind of on its face, literally, is the title, Determined. Now, I'm willing to bet a small amount of money that the title comes from the philosophical concept of determinism. Now, determinism is kind of at a high level, at least as far as I can kind of explain it at a high level. It's quite literally everything is caused by an unbroken series of events from the beginning of everything until now, you know. Anybody who remembers Spaceballs will remember the now problem with Dark Helmet, hopefully. That scene still cracks me up, and it's something that I thought about for a long time, weirdly. But that's another topic. Time is another area of interest for me that I know so little about, but it's really fascinating. Anyway, so I may have said this already before too, right? But, you know, those who have had religion growing up would think about this as predetermined, predestined, right? And the reason I don't necessarily find appeal in the term determinism is it still feels like somebody set the ball rolling. Somebody has determined what is going to happen to me and you and to everybody and to everything. even though to some extent it really just means that it's already. I mean, again, there's a certain amount of cognition involved that determination kind of yields with it. I don't know. I'm probably overthinking it, but I find it questionable at best, semantically, of course. But at any rate, this concept about determinism, this concept of everything having a cause from the very beginning of everything to now, is quite interesting to me. And I'm sure that there are some people out there right now who have a more religious bent that are probably going to bring up the idea of the Big Bang, right? So even if we all agree that the Big Bang is what started what we consider everything, right, within our kind of closed universal system, there's still, who caused that, right? And I'm not, any kind of legitimate physicist worth their salt is going to tell you we don't know, and we can't ever actually find out because there's no way to measure before things existed. But that doesn't mean that it's God. And this is known as the God of the Gaps fallacy. I'm not going to dwell too much on that, but I think that the important part of this is that, you know, everything that has happened has led to this moment for everybody, right? So everybody listening to me right now, everything that has happened for everything, for anything, anywhere, ever, has led you to listening to me breathe funny, right? Because I'm overweight. So that comes with the territory. But, you know, I find this idea fascinating. So the struggle then becomes, I had to look this up, right? I needed to figure out kind of the right way to word this situation that I find myself in and the books that I'm reading, right? And there's analytic philosopher out there by the name of Peter van Inwagen. Inwagen? I mean, it sounds Dutch, and I'm probably butchering it, but he's a professor of philosophy, research professor, I think at Notre Dame, when I looked it up, right? But the way that he says it is, I mean, frankly, I like it. I think it's the simplest way to put this. He says, is it possible for an ordinary human to exercise free will when determinism is true? So that becomes, I mean, that's really the question. Do we have the actual ability of free will? Do we have the ability to make choices? Or is it all this illusion of choice? I think anybody who's seen the Matrix movies may remember that discussion with the Oracle. Was it the Oracle or was it with the Architect? Dang it, now I don't remember. But this idea that there's this illusion of choice, this illusion that we get to determine what it is that we do, as opposed to things kind of happening to us, causing us to do these things. And I think in and of itself, I think part of why I couldn't understand what Sam Harris was saying earlier in his book is I don't know that I could comprehend at the time what it was that he was saying. Like, I wasn't ready to really kind of understand, gain that knowledge. And I think that starts to play as an illustration as to why free will is not a thing. Because, you know, when I was younger, I wanted to know everything. Right. That's what I wanted. I didn't. I had to learn. You still have to learn. You have to continue to learn. And, you know, you're only able to learn so much so fast. And then thanks to, you know, human ingenuity and the forward progression of thought and research and the appropriate scientific rigor, you know, by the time you learn everything about a subject, I'm going to say largely obsolete, but I'm sure a lot of it is obsolete because we've learned more, right? If we use technology as kind of a metric of knowledge, you look at how computers have evolved, and we keep getting better and better at making neater and neater technology. We make it smaller, we make it more energy efficient. It's the same thing with just general knowledge. You know, the more we learn, we reach, I don't want to say a new plateau, but we reach a new level of understanding, and then we gain more. That's a really long explanation for keep learning, right? Keep being curious. Always be curious. That to me is what ABC stands for. Always be curious. Now, so I want to dive into where, you know, Dr. Harris and Dr. Sapolsky, right? Neuroscientists, neurosurgeons, philosophers, authors, right? I mean, it's neat to me how they, you know, agree with each other. And I'm going to give you a quote from each one of them. And there's a quote by Carl Sagan that is also similar to this. And I don't have it handy. And I don't want to try to paraphrase it because I'm sure I will screw it up. But maybe I'll post it somewhere later just as a reminder. But one of the ones I found from Sam Harris, which I'm pretty sure is a combination of from his book Free Will, an interview he did, you know, ages ago, right? So this is all 10, 12, 13 years ago. So Sam Harris says, "I see nothing irrational about seeking the states of mind that lie at the core of many religions. Compassion, awe, devotion, and feelings of oneness are surely among the most valuable experiences a person can have. Ecstasy, rapture, bliss, concentration, a sense of the sacred. I'm comfortable with all of that. I think all of that is indispensable, and I think it's frankly lost on much of the atheist community." I really like that. I really identify that. I have admittedly struggled with some of that because it's tough to want to live kind of exclusively by, you know, evidence and reason and logic. And you know, you can't. I mean, I determined a few years back that you can logic yourself within a situation to get to, you know, two places that are equally of value. They'll have equally beneficial outcomes. There's essentially no difference if you pick A or B. So what do you do? How do you make that decision? Well, you have to have some level of emotion, right? You have to have some level of something else in your system that tells you which one that you ultimately want to do, right? And maybe that's the whole free will thing. But as we're going to kind of find out, or we're going to discuss, that free will isn't a thing. Anyway, it's hard to separate what I think about things versus what I'm beginning to understand about things, right? So some of the verbiage is going to be kind of back and forth. So if you're looking to ping me on inconsistencies as far as how I'm presenting this information, or what it is I'm presenting as far as what I think or these ideas, great. What I definitely want to do at this point is get into a couple of other quotes from both Sam and Sapolsky from their books, because I think this can help to kind of sum up, again, kind of briefly, their argument. Just, you know, like an introduction, a summary of their argument. So from Sam, in his book Free Will, he says, "We are conscious of only a tiny fraction of the information that our brains process in each moment. Although we continually notice changes in our experience, in thought, mood, perception, behavior, etc., we are utterly unaware of the neurophysiological events that produce them. In fact, we can be very poor witnesses to experience itself. By merely glancing at your face or listening to your tone of voice, others are often more aware of your state of mind and motivations than you are." I mean, it's interesting to think about when you stop and take that step back and you take a real granular lurk at what it's like to be a brain. It's all these things have to happen in order for anything to happen within our bodies. And, you know, I definitely appreciated that statement at the time, but I think that Sapolsky's explanation goes a little deeper and might be a tad more thorough as far as beginning to raise the question about the existence of free will. So Sapolsky says, "Find me the neuron that started this process in this man's brain. The neuron that had an action potential for no reason, where no neuron spoke to it just before, then show me that this neuron's actions were not influenced by whether the man was tired, hungry, stressed, or in pain at the time. That nothing about this neuron's function was altered by the sights, sounds, smells, and so on, experienced by the man in the previous minutes, nor by the levels of any hormones marinating his brain in the previous hours to days, nor whether he had experienced a life-changing event in recent months or years. And show me that this neuron's supposedly freely willed functioning wasn't affected by the man's genes, or by the lifelong changes in regulation of those genes caused by experiences during his childhood, nor by levels of hormones he was exposed to as a fetus when that brain was being constructed, nor by the centuries of history and ecology that shaped the invention of the culture in which he was raised. Show me a neuron being a causeless cause in this total sense. Show me a neuron or brain whose generation of a behavior is independent of the sum of its biological past and And for the purposes of this book, you've demonstrated free will. So this is, you know, of course, a much more in-depth kind of conversation. Like this really brings you to that individual step by step by step of what's going on. And, you know, I think, especially if you start thinking about like time and how we're affected by it, by time, or how we perceive time, and the idea of processing information at that level, of thinking about it, that step by step by step, it's daunting. Like, I don't know that I would have ever reached what Sapolsky was saying based on what Sam Harris was saying. And again, I got to reread Free Will, so he may have said something similar that I just did not grasp. But I think that they're at least onto something. Like, believe it or not, it's difficult, I think, to square the circle. And I mean, you know, I've decided to raise my hands in confusion, and you can't see me on the screen, right? Why did that happen? I'm expressing an emotion. Well, why am I raising my hands while expressing that emotion, especially when there's nobody to watch me? You know, it's some of these deeper questions that, I mean, we ask, I think we ask generically of people when they do something that we don't quite understand, like, why did you do that? And people, I don't know. My 12-year-old does that to me. Why did you? I don't know. Okay. So it does kind of raise some doubt. But at the same time, you know, it's weird to think about this idea that we don't know kind of what we're doing or who we are, or I don't know. I think I'm starting to get into the realm of where I don't really know like how to process this. But again, I'm only in chapter one. I got to reread the other book. I think it's a fascinating topic. I think it's a fascinating idea. And one of the things that I've heard from Sapolsky on interviews, you know, where people are kind of questioning him about this, because he's brought this up before. I mean, it's clear for him. It's been something he's understood since he was a teenager. I am fascinated by this idea, these concepts, and I hope to learn more about it and hope to be able to explain it to more people. And whether people believe it or not is, I mean, for you, it's your choice, right? Because it's your free will. And for guys like Harris and Sapolsky, and there are plenty of others that are coming to the same conclusion. So I'm sorry, I'm backtracking. There was a statement that Sapolsky has made, and that's that I've seen on a couple of different videos, just interviews he's had, and you know, the way to kind of phrase it, as opposed to it's your choice, it's just that, you know, at this moment, you are the kind of person that X, right? Which, you know, for Sapolsky, there's a certain amount of, you know, inability to punish people. Right, I don't remember if I mentioned this or not, but you know, where he has this kind of stance that it's hard to, you know, you can't judge people when it's not their fault, it wasn't their choice, and this is where I definitely diverge from the good doctor, and I don't remember Harris's take on this, but I do believe that there are some actions that are, I mean, punishable is the wrong word. That I think should be handled in a deliberate and final way. And I know that there's real risk in saying that. There's real risk in this idea that the solution, which is already going to be a charged word, is to remove certain specific people from the board because of certain specific actions. I know a number of people have argued that it's a deterrent, right? So it's an activity that's supposed to be a deterrent for people to not commit crime. That's not how crime works. I've known that for a while. And it's not about punishment, because the idea of punishment suggests that there's a certain amount of retribution to it, right? It's really about paying somebody back for something that they did. You know, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, punishment fits the crime. And we have these phrases that iterate the idea that somebody did something, we should do it back to them. For me, it's, you know, it's more about putting down an animal who has a disease that is harmful to others, and one that, you know, either can't be resolved or in some respects, I think there are some activities that, you know, you got one shot and you took that shot and that's it. That's it. That's all it takes. I think that the solution to the situation we find ourselves in is to hop over your piece on the checkerboard, to, you know, knock your pawn over with a rook or something, right? And I know for some people that sounds harsh. And I think that trying to legislate something like that is also very difficult and has a real penchant for abuse, which is, you know, unfortunately part of the human experience. And I wish, I don't know, maybe after reading Sapolsky's stuff, I will find a different way to view this and to think about it. But as it stands right now, I think there's some, and I'm not going to get into the specifics, but there are perpetrators out there who do not need to still be out there. I don't mean to bring it to a downer level, but I definitely wanted to bring it up because I also want to see if my attitudes change over the course of the reading. So I wanted to be honest about kind of where I am on the topic. But ultimately, you know, it's about the journey. It's about, you know, learning. It's about trying to understand better what reality is, what life really is, and how we fit into that. You know, how we fit into that for ourselves, how we fit into that for other people. And yeah, so at the moment, I am the kind of person who's interested in this topic. You know, that's my deterministic existence, and it coincides with my free will. So I guess we both win. Thanks for sticking it out, and I will talk to you again soon.